Hogner and NAU Country Insurance in this case. I will assume the court is familiar with the facts and go right into the legal argument inasmuch as there are many issues to cover here. Today, if this court makes any one of three findings, then the award of punitive damages against my client, Levi Hogner, should be vacated. If the court finds...
I'm sorry, Ms. Kingsley, can you just wait one moment? Okay. There's been a buzzing sound that interferes with your communication with the court, but it's been taken care of, I think. So... And before you proceed, I'm expecting Justice Rogensack back on the bench. Justice Prosser will not be participating.
Should I go ahead?
Yes, you may. Proceed.
Okay. It's our position that if the court makes any one of three findings today, that the award of punitive damages against Levi Hogner should be vacated. If the court holds that the statute, the punitive damages statute, which talks about disregard of the rights of the plaintiff, if the court finds that of the plaintiff means of the plaintiff, then this award should be vacated. Two, or in the alternative, if the court found that the intent in the statute, the intent to disregard the rights, means intent to do the act and cause the consequence, then the award against Mr. Hogner should be vacated. And finally, if the court were to find that the punitive damages award in this case, which had a ratio of 112-1 against an individual person, was excessive and therefore unconstitutional, then this award should be vacated. So on any three of those grounds, this award should be vacated. Alternatively, in order to find for Mr. Strankey and to uphold this award, the court would have to find all of the following. The court would have to find that of the plaintiff in the statute does not mean of the plaintiff. The court would have to find that the Wisher decision was incorrect, that the Boomsma court's interpretation was incorrect, that the Civil Jury Instruction Committee's interpretation was incorrect, that the definition of plaintiff in the punitive damages statute is not correct, and that a punitive damage award with a ratio of 112-1 against an individual in this state is not unconstitutional. I'll start with a statutory interpretation argument. The statute that we're dealing with, obviously, here is the punitive damages statute, which is set out at 895.85. And that says that in order for there to be an award of punitive damages, the plaintiff must prove that the defendant acted with maliciously toward the plaintiff or in intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. So I'll talk first about intentional disregard, because I think we have some issues here both as to what of the plaintiff means and intentional disregard. Intentional disregard of the plaintiff was interpreted by the Rules Committee when doing the jury instructions. It's been interpreted in the Wisher case, which this court will hear later today.
Counsel, don't you start first with the plain meaning of the statute?
I agree with that.
Can you start with the wording of the statute to get to the plain meaning, right?
Definitely. First let me talk about the plain meaning then. Plain meaning, the easiest, we'll start out with the easiest example. You have to intend the acts to be directed toward the plaintiff. That's the plain meaning of the statute in this case. The statute, which is kind of unusual, the statute defines plaintiff within the statute itself. And the statute says the plaintiff is the person, not a person, but the person seeking to recover punitive damages. So it's defined in the statute. Strankey's argument is of the plaintiff doesn't mean of the plaintiff, which is simply ridiculous in this case. They defined it within the statute. The legislature intended to punish the conduct of the particular person. And this court states that this court will interpret the statute so that no provision is rendered meaningless whenever possible.
How can you say the plaintiff means the plaintiff in this case, since there's no way that the defendant can know who the plaintiff is going to be?
Well, that's exactly true, and the legislature considered that issue before they passed the law.
Well, if that's true, that you don't know who the plaintiff is going to be, then what does the law mean?
The law means that punitive damages should be available in intentional tort situations.
Only.
And I've sat and tried to think if there are exceptions to that, and I cannot think of an exception because they use the word intentional. And then what the courts have done and what the Civil Rules Committee did is say, okay, what is intentional? And intentional is defined under the criminal law because there is no definition under the civil law.
Well, and that would mean it would be assault and battery. Can't be products liability because you don't need intent in that.
Under the strict reading of the statute, that's true.
You don't need negligence. So it's personal injury. What other intentional torts are there in personal injury? Defamation.
Bad faith, as there have been cases in here. There's another case that talks about trespass.
So you've limited it that narrowly.
That's because the statute limits it that narrowly. And one of my primary points here today is the court may not like what the statute says. I may not like what the statute says, but that is what the statute says, because to interpret it any other way leads to ridiculous results. I think the Wisher Court talks about you're not knocking on the door, you're knocking the door down, or you're knocking the wall down, because if you don't interpret it as intentionally as the criminal definition is, then any negligence case becomes a punitive damages case.
So what's the intent? The intent to injure the plaintiff?
The intent to injure or harm the plaintiff, correct.
But it doesn't say that. It says intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff.
And so we look for what that means, since they didn't define it in the statute. And the only place it is defined is in the criminal context. And the courts have held that the criminal definition applies in civil instances. Because, again, if you don't include the intent to harm, then if I knowingly exceed the speed limit, not that that's ever happened, but if I did that and I accidentally hit someone, that's a punitive damage case.
But intent in the criminal statutes does not always mean intent to harm. Intent modifies another aspect. And in this case, at least under this statute, doesn't it modify disregarding rights?
But what does...
How do you get to injury or harm from there?
But what does disregarding rights mean? I disregard the rights of other motorists if I'm speeding. I disregard the rights of other motorists if I'm talking on a cell phone.
Or if you're driving drunk.
Correct. But the statute says there has to be intent to do that, and it has to be directed at the plaintiff. And again, that's whether we like that language or not.
That's now directed at the plaintiff. If the court were to find, and I don't know that the court's going to do this, but if the court were to find that there was an intentional disregard of the rights of all the motorists that were on that road, doesn't that necessarily include the plaintiff?
Well, but the State Farm Court talked about that, and the State Farm Court specifically says that you have to, the conduct has to be directed at the plaintiff. It says that it's not fair and it's not constitutional to award damages for hypothetical claims of hypothetical plaintiffs.
Foreseeable plaintiff? This is another motorist on the road at the same time. This isn't a hypothetical. This is a person that's on the road at the time this individual is driving.
But the statute doesn't say foreseeable plaintiffs. It defines it as the plaintiff making the claim. So under the statute, no. And as we pointed out, under the statute, any other result opens every court in this state up to multitudes of claims. Because if you take out intent to harm or directly affect the rights of the plaintiff out of that statute, it's basically a negligent statute. You've kind of abrogated the whole world to intentional there.
How does that differ from malicious?
The intent to harm?
Yes.
Well, the statute uses both words in the statute. It uses the word maliciously. Maliciously is used as an adverb. Dictionaries talk about malicious means evil intent.
Mm-hmm.
Intent to harm is different. Intent to harm is intent to cause a specific action in that case. I think that maliciously is kind of a broad penumbra, and intent to harm is a specific meaning within that. And so I know Mr. Stranke has argued, Well, if you say there's an intent to harm, then it's duplicative of what is said earlier in the statute. We disagree with that because I think there are differences, although subtle, between the two words. And beside that, if you look at...
Didn't you just argue that it's a subset of malicious?
Malicious means evil intent. I guess I don't mean subset because it's an offshoot, but you have a specific intent to harm the person in that case. Malicious can be, someone can gossip. It can be considered malicious. I think there are different terms, and I think the legislature used them similarly to, say, for example, the wrongful death statute. When it talks about loss of consortium claims, they talk about loss of society and companionship. They're different concepts. Some people would argue they're duplicative, but there are two concepts, to broaden.
Consortium relates to spouses.
Correct.
And loss of society and companionship relates to more than spouses and relates to different kinds of damages. So I don't think that's a good example.
Well, I just use it to indicate that there are two words within the same sentence that most people are going to argue have the same meaning. But nevertheless, the legislature is not without repetition in some of the laws it passed. And I bring that up because Mr. Strankey is arguing that the repetition means that our interpretation of that statute could not be correct.
Counselor, I have just two questions about the plaintiff and the particularization that you ascribe to it. Are you hanging your hat on the fact that under subsection 1C it says the party when it's describing plaintiff, and if it said a party, would your argument hold together?
Both that subset, correct. In both the portion where it talks about the punitive damages, it talks about the plaintiff, and in the definition section. And
if that's what you're saying, you know, we have more than one plaintiff here, how does that definition apply at all when you have multiple parties who are suing?
Well, in this case, it talks about the definition of plaintiff talks about the person bringing the claim in that case. So what I'm saying is I certainly don't think that they would exclude a spouse if two spouses are bringing the claim together. It's talking about the people to that lawsuit.
Well, you're hanging it on the particularized article, which is the. You might also read that as including a or including all. Because we don't always have one plaintiff. Sometimes we have many plaintiffs. Sometimes they're not spouses.
Well, that would require us, though, to assume that the legislature didn't intend what it said.
Well, it depends on how you read what it says to some degree. My other question for you is, do we look at, in regard to defining intent, the many instructions that Mr. Hoegner has had that when he drinks, his driving is impaired, and I talk about his past convictions. Does that bear on whether or not intent was shown here?
The courts have certainly looked at whether or not there's recidivism. Mr. Hoegner has had certainly driven intoxicated in the past. He admitted that. There have never been accidents, that type of thing. However, when you look at his notice and the reprehensibility of his acts, you have to look at what caused the injuries. What caused the injuries in the case was a left-hand turn. There was no testimony from a toxicologist or anything of that sort saying that that is what caused the accident. That certainly is not excusing his behavior. What caused the accident, according to the evidence that did come in, is Mr. Hoegner saw a vehicle. He thought it had its right turn signal on. He thought, I can turn before they do, and he made a left-hand turn. So the actual action that caused the injury in this case was a left-hand turn.
But you can argue that. You can also argue, as was argued at the trial court level, that his judgment about what he should do was impaired because of his alcohol content, whether or not that was specified in the testimony for the claim that was made here, I don't think is really in the record, at least as far as I could determine.
Well, the reason I raise this issue is because of the Livro case, which is a case out of this state which came out before the change in the law. So that court was applying the general, more liberal standard. And in that case, you had a defendant who the testimony said had been drinking, slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, et cetera. There was no evidence in that case as to the actual blood alcohol content. but there was testimony that she was impaired. What the court held in that case is they remanded the punitive damages and ordered that it be dismissed because there was no evidence linking the drinking to the accident itself. But more importantly in that case, the court said that there was no otherwise outrageous conduct. That defendant had blown through a stop sign. And the court said that doesn't raise to the level of outrageous conduct. So it was dismissed. In this case, it's a similar thing. There's alcohol involved. There's no testimony at trial as to the relationship between the two. And what happened was not a drunk driver weaving down the road, taking out mailboxes. It was a left-hand turn, the type of accident that happens every day, regardless of whether someone is sober or inebriated.
Right, but in the Liberal case, there weren't the repetitious OMVWIs that we have here, were there?
I don't recall that. I don't know that there was in that case. That goes to the foreseeability of the conduct, but the court still found that's kind of a different element.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, what troubles me is how we evaluate the difference between the common law standard and what the legislature was trying to do when they put intent in there. So I look at recklessness, because that was always the easiest one to prove under the common law, and what more than the common law standard is required to get into the statutory standard. And it seems to me that if someone is repeatedly told that their judgment is impaired while they're driving, and they're told by way of judicial citations, not just Mary telling Johnny, I don't like to drive with you because you don't drive so good when you've had a few, that could bear upon the intent level that the legislature is setting out here.
Well, I think we address that when we talk about the debate which took place on the assembly floor when the recidivist issue did come up. And the example was given, this law is going to prevent punitive damages in a case where you have a drunk driver this is their third time. They bring up the example in that case of a little child runs out and this little child is severely injured. And the legislator concludes no punitive damages. And that discussion took place, and the legislature knew the possibility of that outcome, and the bill passed anyway. In fact, before the bill passed, either out of the Assembly or the Senate, attempts were made to bring in amendments which broadened it, which would have included these types of claims, that the amendments were to make the language basically the same as it had been under common law, recklessness.
If I could ask you about those, because I'm looking at the transcripts that have been provided as part of the record, the manuscript transcript of the proceeding, and it appears, if I'm reading correctly, that much of the discussion, and I'm looking at pages 85 and 86 of the transcripts, looking at the first full paragraph on page 85 and looking at the last paragraph for speaker 87 on page 86, they talk in terms of the word intentional being the change, and then they link it to intentional disregard. They focus that's where they didn't try to say that we're dealing with intent to harm. That still was linked to disregard. So when you talk about the plain meaning of the statute, the only way you get to intent to harm is if you read some ambiguity into the statute that means more than what it says. If you go back here, they're still linking it to disregard.
Well, I think under the recent Kellel decision, there doesn't have to be ambiguity to look at the legislative history. I mean, as the court said, if the statute is plain meaning, you can use that decision to help clarify or bolster the plain meaning, which in this case we would argue we did. I think that there is certainly other debate which takes place, and there are many legislators who, you know, got up and gave their ideas about what it would mean. The part you're quoting took place, and I think there was some give and take on that issue. I raised the discussion which took place about the recidivism and punitive damages just to point out that when this was passed, the legislators had discussed that this would be a possible outcome.
I have a question about this. This is a transcript of the floor debate. It was not provided by the Assembly. Isn't that right? The Assembly does not transcribe its floor debates, as I understand it. Where does this transcript come from?
This transcript, frankly, came from the briefs in the case we're going to hear this afternoon.
No, but who ordered the transcript?
I do not know who ordered the transcript.
Okay. Was this transcript part of the record in your case?
It was not part of the record below, no.
You just provided it here?
Correct.
Okay, for purposes of statutory interpretation.
Correct.
So you're saying it's ambiguous. Otherwise, we don't look at it. This is about the, most excessive legislative history we've ever seen, because we generally don't get floor debates. We generally get written documents that are in the drafting record, most of which appeared before the legislature.
When you say that I'm saying it's ambiguous, are you referring to the statute or the floor debate?
I'm referring to the statute. You don't ever look beyond the statute if there's no ambiguity.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think this court fairly recently in the Kalel decision
I'm familiar.
Yes, I know. I think that decision says that you can look to it even if there's not ambiguity. If the language is clear, you can look at it nevertheless to basically solidify the language that you are discussing.
Okay, so that's your basis here.
Right.
All right. And what part solidifies?
The discussion about the fact, would this get rid of punitive damages in difficult cases such as this? And we raise it for the fact that, yes, it was, this issue was contemplated by the legislature before the bill was passed.
Now, counsel, I think what was contemplated, according to the transcript that I read, was that there was a heightened standard of conduct. I don't think anybody disputes that. That's what the legislature clearly intended. But your issue, linking that redefined where the intent went, I didn't see that anywhere in that transcript. And if it's there, I would appreciate it if you could point us to that.
I see what you're saying. I don't think that the legislative debate concretely addressed what happens with the intent. And that's why we refer to the other legal authorities and where intent is defined within
But I think it does. I think there are a number of places, once again on page 98, there are a number of places where it links intent to disregard and where they were clearly saying we're getting rid of willful, wanton, and reckless. And we're substituting intent. We're not changing anything else.
But it didn't talk about what disregard of rights means.
That's true.
Well, look at lines 14 and 15. I think those are the ones that...
What page are you on?
98.
Thank
it's
you.
828 in the reply brief. Not the action being intentional, but disregard for plaintiff's rights. And that's what the fight's about.
Right.
As I understand it, doesn't mean I'm right, but... So the point being, if you're using this to confirm your interpretation, there are parts of this that don't. And we would like, if you can, for you to identify those language that confirms your interpretation. And even if you do, you got other language here that doesn't.
Right, and I think that's one of the problems with the floor debate. I think you do have language going back and forth on both sides of it. And that's why when we're talking about intent, I'm not looking at the floor debate on what disregard of rights means. I think you need to look at what the other laws on that issue mean or what they say. Because, again, if you don't accept the interpretation by the Wisher Court in Boomsma and by the jury committee, all then you have to prove is a disregard of rights, which means every negligence case in this state becomes a potential punitive damages case.
Counsel, the reverse of that, a concern for the reverse of that was voiced by the Court of Appeals in their certification. You are asserting that every case will become a punitive damages case, yet the Court of Appeals in talking about this argument that it had to be geared towards the particular plaintiff. On page 6 of its certification says, really questions the interpretation of what you would call the literal interpretation and the interpretation given by Boonsma. And it, the Court of Appeals, offers its own hypothetical. And the own hypothetical was, look, let's say you have a drug company who's manufacturing a drug that it knows is practically certain to cause harm. And it wants to make money, and it manufactures that and distributes that, knowing that it is, according to the certification, practically certain to cause harm. But even though the class of people who use the drug are harmed, and that the manufacturer knew that this was practically certain to occur, the drug manufacturer could simply use the plain language that you are asserting and say, oh, it didn't intend to harm Mr. Philip Smith from Decatur, Iowa, who's the plaintiff and who suffered brain damage, and therefore no products liability case. The Court of Appeals in its certification is implying that your interpretation really would virtually wipe out products liability, punitive damages and products liability cases. And as I went through the drafting records here, I mean, that to me seems like quite a sea change to wipe out the potential of products, punitive damages and products liability. And I couldn't see anything in the drafting records for this act that would indicate that anyone intended that type of sea change. Is there anything that you can point to in the drafting records that supports your interpretation of that kind of consequence?
A broad-ranging result? The only thing that I see, and again, I refer back, it's in the same section where one of the legislators talks about...
I mean, I'm talking about the drafting records, not the transcript, but the drafting records.
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
Legislation. Anything at all in the drafting records that you can point to that supports your interpretation, which would mean the particularized plaintiff, that the defendant would have to intend to harm that particularized plaintiff wherever he or she may live.
Not that I'm aware of in the records. However, if the thought was to codify common law, they took it a step well beyond that. And had they intended not for it to be aimed at a specific person, then A, they shouldn't have given the definition within the statute, and B, they should have codified the language of common law, which talked about reckless disregard of the rights of others. They chose not to do that, and they fought two attempts to broaden this bill as well. And they stuck to their guns and kept plaintiff in there. And again, as I said, in an unusual step, defined plaintiff within the statute itself.
Thank you, Ms. Kingsley. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Lynn R. Laufenberg representing the plaintiffs, the Strenkies. Mr. Laufenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. My name is Lynn Laufenberg, and I'm honored to have been asked to make a presentation to this court today supporting the jury's determination in this case that punitive damages in a significant amount are necessary to both punish and deter this multi-offender drunk driver. In an attempt to avoid the consequences of this determination by the jury, Mr. Hogner argues that the legislature, in enacting Section 895-85 sub 3, intended to overrule the longstanding determination of the Court of Appeals in Leverell that civil punitive damages should be available in the arsenal against the scourge of drunk driving. As a fallback and secondary argument, Mr. Hogner contends that the jury's $225,000 punitive damage assessment violates principles of due process because the actual damages found by the jury in the bifurcated compensatory component of the trial, which resulted from his egregious conduct, were only $2,000. We respectfully suggest to the court that there is nothing in the language of the statute or in its history to suggest that the legislature intended that repeat drunk drivers be relieved of potential exposure to punitive damages. Further, the jury's assessment of punitive damages in this case clearly withstands scrutiny when viewed in the context of the factors that have been identified by the United States Supreme Court and applied by this Court in several cases, most recently in the Trinity case, as being relevant to a due process analysis. On the legislative intent issue, I am mindful of the different points of view that have been expressed in the opinions of this Court concerning how legislative intent is to be determined, and I suggest that whether you use, which without regard to which approach is used, whether it's the scope, history, and context approach or the plain meaning approach, and I probably improperly shorthanded those terms, you come to the same conclusion. The end point of that conclusion is that the legislature had no intent to exclude juries from assessing punitive damages in these situations. On the second topic, which is going to be a focal point of discussion this afternoon, I'm also mindful of the arguments that are being presented in the Wisher case, and which Wisher decision is the source of the concern by the Court of Appeals in its certification to this Court. The majority in Wisher could certainly not have considered the far-reaching implications of its interpretation of Section 895.83, certainly not as argued by Mr. Hoegner in this case. I believe that an interpretation of Section 895.83 sub 3 that leads to a determination that repeat drunk drivers are no longer subject to punishment and deterrence by civil assessment of punitive damages is inherently unreasonable and absurd.
Is the intentional standard that's listed in the statute a subjective standard, proof-wise or objective?
It has to be subjective because if one accepts the proposition that the jury or that the legislature intended to raise the bar, as it were, for the determination of punitive damages in this state, it's a question of the conduct, the state of mind, the awareness, the viewpoint of the particular defendant as it concerns the rights which are being exposed to violation by his or her conduct.
What about the phrase disregards the rights? Is that an objective standard or a subjective standard?
Well, I'm not sure how you're using the objective-subjective dichotomy with that question, Justice Robertson.
Would one have to prove that this plaintiff knew that what he was doing could result in this case, an injury as the right that was affected? Or would it be the reasonable man would know that this conduct would produce an injury
I think it's a combination of the two, because you're often going to get, as you get in this case, testimony by the defendant that I didn't intend to hurt anybody. I wasn't intending to cause any harm. That belies common sense.
That goes to the intent part. I'm kind of looking at the disregarding what is encompassed in that phrase.
Well, disregard of rights is, first of all, we have to define rights, and that obviously is a question for the law and for the courts, but rights in this instance is to be free from the risk of harm by people who violate the law by driving drunk on our roadways.
Is it the risk of harm or is it being actually harmed?
It's the risk of harm.
Why?
Well, because that's what the context of the common law has, which hasn't been totally eliminated by this statute. I think if we take this statute in the context of the common law, we are talking about risk of harm as opposed to probability or certainty of harm as a factor to determine whether there ought to be punitive damages assessed.
Yeah, but you have to have actual harm and either nominal or compensatory damages before you ever get to punitive damages, so why is it just a risk and not an actuality?
Well, because you can never say with certainty that even in the pharmaceutical case, not everybody who takes the drug, I would assume, is going to be injured by that drug. But the risk is there.
But somebody has to take it to be injured in order for the case to be brought.
Yes. And that person has to have been injured under our law in order to have, and has to have compensatory damages, whether nominal or actual, in order to support a jury's consideration of punitives.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Loffenberg,
yes.
Have you or are you about to get to the racial issue here?
I'd be happy to address
anything about that this morning, and I'm interested in that. I'm especially concerned about what I've heard about the ratio here being approximately 112.5 to 1. How do you think that's justified given Trinity, given State Farm, given the other cases, certainly BMW as well?
Well, it's justified from two perspectives. First of all, we know that $2,000 was the jury award for compensatory damages for the personal injury. But we have in the record here, particularly at appellant's appendix, page 25, and appellant's appendix, page 13, the deposition testimony of the participants in this accident, Mr. Strenke and Hogner, in which they describe both vehicles being totaled in this accident. Now, no value is assigned to those vehicles. In other words, there is no evidence in the record that the jury was required to consider or make an award for that value, but both vehicles were totaled. That's a property damage, which is something additional to the compensatory damages that were incurred from a personal injury standpoint in this case. And it doesn't take a lot in this context to change the ratio from 112 to 1 to half that or a third of that. And that's why a bright-line fixed ratio test has never been – that's one of the reasons a bright-line fixed ratio test has never been accepted as the basis for determining whether a jury's punitive damage award violates due process. A second and a compelling reason in this case is that on the grievousness or reprehensibility issue, which is one of the factors that the court in State Farm and BMW identified as a determiner in finding a due process violation, a sub-factor is whether the injury, whether the action caused personal injury or put persons at risk for personal injury or were represented a disregard of the safety of people as opposed to purely economic harm. And in this case, clearly, it was a personal injury risk that was presented by the defendants driving while severely intoxicated without regard to the claim that he didn't think he was impaired or that it didn't cause this accident. We see that very frequently in these cases.
One of the things, if I might just continue with this for a minute, one of the things that troubles me is the fact that counsel, in arguing for punitive damages, argued for $25,000, and the jury returned a verdict of $225,000 on punitive damages. Does that enter into our review of the question of excessiveness of punitive damages?
Certainly the court's entitled to its own view of excessiveness, but it shouldn't be dictated by what counsel for the plaintiff thought in his suggestion to the jury was a reasonable amount of money. The jury is also instructed, as being a former trial judge, you know, that they are to consider the closing arguments of counsel, but the closing argument of counsel, particularly with regard to the amount of damages, is no measure of those damages, and juries are repeatedly encouraged to exercise their independent judgment and discretion in determining what amount is appropriate. Now, as a trial lawyer myself, in trying purely compensatory damage cases, I often am concerned, am I going to state an amount that will turn this jury away from my client? And I make a willful decision to be conservative in the amount I suggest, at the same time acknowledging that to the jury, in closing, that the jury has the right to make whatever award it feels is fair. And not infrequently, unfortunately not all the time, but not infrequently, a jury does not accept my conservative estimate and awards a greater amount. That does not mean that the amount is excessive, and neither does it mean it's excessive here. The third point, in answer to your first question, Justice Crooks, is that you not only consider the reprehensibility, and in this case, the fact that it exposed people to personal risk, but also you consider the potential harm that could have resulted to this plaintiff. And the circumstances of this accident, accidents, if we call them though, accidents are a combination of circumstances that happen to produce a unique result. Very often that combination cannot be reproduced. And a slightly different variation in the facts of this accident could have resulted in very significant injuries to Mr. Strenke or to Mr. Hogner's passenger in his vehicle. And it wouldn't, again, take very much in the way of additional compensatory damages to dramatically change the ratio.
What authority do you have for the potential harm argument?
That's State Farm versus Campbell. And this Court's discussion in Trinity and the other cases in which it has talked about the fact that the harm was limited in some way to a particular award that the jury made is not the end point in consideration of whether the punitive damage assessment violates due process. It also must consider the fact that of the potential for harm that existed to these plaintiffs and, frankly, some people would argue to other people, meaning other people on the roadway, at the time that this injury happened to occur.
We're looking at a ratio, and admittedly the ratio is not binding. But if we're looking at a ratio, how do we measure potential harm? What kind of facts have to be in the record to be looking at potential harm?
I don't know that you have to have specific facts to demonstrate what the degree of potential harm is. All you need to do is to look at the circumstances in which the injury occurred, and in the context of common sense and understanding of what this kind of conduct can produce, look at the range of things that can occur from that conduct. In an automobile collision, it can be a very severe disabling injury. It could be death. And even one of those cases, all of a sudden, you've got an award of compensatory damages potentially exceeding the punitive damage assessment in this case. The Supreme Court has indicated that and the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that's an perfectly acceptable analysis, not that it's the only consideration that ought to enter into this, but it is one consideration that ought to enter into this, as well as, quite frankly, the fact that this is a repeat offender. This is somebody who hasn't learned from the multiple opportunities he's had to become aware. We all know, as you do, that convicted drunk drivers are required to attend alcohol assessment programs, classes, and in those classes they're repeatedly reminded of the risk that comes from drinking and driving, the increase in that risk that is associated with the increase in the use of alcohol, the level of impairment increases the risk, and quite frankly, the fact that you cannot always personally trust your judgment about how impaired you are.
Mr. Loffenberg, if I could, what about Ms. Kingsley's argument that what the statute in this particular instance was attempting to do was to apply only in intentional tort settings?
I don't think that makes sense because you would have to, if I could use the term, disregard the phrase disregard of rights, because the Court of Appeals in Wisher substituted harm for disregard of rights. We have no problem with the Judicial Civil Jury Instruction Committee's analysis of what it means to act intentionally. But the question is not to act intentionally, it's to act intentionally to do what? And the statute says intentional disregard of rights, not intentional harm. And as it was pointed out in the questioning of Ms. Kingsley earlier, to take the interpretation that the Wisher Court applied to this would be to say that punitive damages are only available in intentional tort cases and in aggravated intentional tort cases at that. And that subset of cases is already subsumed in the wording that the legislature adapted from common law, malicious conduct.
Mr. Laufenberg, how does the statute differ from the common law?
That's an excellent question, and only this Court can answer it, but I give you my thoughts on it. What it appears that the legislature did was to keep the first criteria for punitive damages, that is malicious conduct, where there's a demonstration of evil intent in the definitions that this Court has applied over the years, malicious are those acts which are the result of hatred, ill will, a desire for revenge, or inflicted under circumstances where insult or injury is intended. That's been maintained. So you're directing conduct at a particular plaintiff and you're acting maliciously. What the legislature appears to have done...
The evil intent to injure that plaintiff.
That's correct.
Okay.
Directing conduct toward that particular plaintiff with an evil intent. The second category under the common law was willful, wanton, or reckless disregard of rights. Now, willful and wanton and reckless disregard of rights have also been defined by this Court. It appears that the legislature substituted the term intentional for disregard of rights for the common law standard, willful, wanton, and reckless disregard of rights. If you look at willful and wanton, those two terms, as variously defined over the years by this Court, do appear to set to require some manifest intent, that is, be conscious of the consequences of your actions, that is, conduct that the conduct will in all probability result in harm. That's a definition of wanton from an older case of this Court. Willful, similarly, proceeding in the face of a known consequence, whether you intend the consequence or not. Those two terms would seem to be, with respect, analogous or subsumed within the concept, the legislative word, intentional. You still need some sort of not just a volitional act, but something that demonstrates proceeding consciously in the face of a risk that, in the context of punitive damages, not just volitional, such as running through a stop sign or failing to stop at a stop sign, unless there's something more to it. What seems to have been dropped out of the mix with regard to punitive damages under the statutory standard is the recklessness concept, where a person acts of commission or omission, which are in reckless disregard. In other words, you're not looking for, you don't care about the consequences of your volitional act. It's not that you're acting in conscious disregard, but you don't care about those consequences, and you proceed in the face of information that either could have been made available or was available to you, and you didn't take advantage of it. So what this Court and the courts in the state are going to have to struggle with is what's going to happen in those cases in which the Court has articulated a support for punitive damages on the basis of reckless disregard of rights. And some of those are product liability cases. Now, I would suggest that that doesn't mean that none of those cases would have qualified for consideration of punitive damages under the statutory standard. It's just that a different strainer, if you will, a different sifter will be applied to by the trial judge, first of all, as to whether there was what the conduct was, whether it included elements of an intentional disregard, a willfulness, a wantonness, as opposed to recklessness. In some of those cases, the trial judge may have concluded anyway, that there was enough evidence to submit it to a jury. With a new instruction on the second level, the jury will have to decide with an instruction of intentional disregard of rights as opposed to willful, wanton, and reckless disregard of rights, whether that conduct in their mind justifies punitive damages. And then on the third level, an appellate court asked to review it will have to apply the same standard in light of the conduct that evidence of conduct that's admitted. That does not, as I said, mean that in all cases where this Court upheld a punitive damage award and used the terminology that the record showed reckless disregard of rights, that those punitive damage awards would not be sustained under the current statute.
Counselor, what's your take on why the legislature decided to define plaintiff when they enacted this provision?
I do not know. I would suggest that, however, that it couldn't have meant the plaintiff as interpreted in Boomsma, which is Judge Randa's district court decision, and as argued by Hogner here, because it emasculates, as has already been pointed out in response to Ms. Kingsley's argument, the idea that you can have a potential exposure for punitive damages even though you didn't intend to injure the particular plaintiff. One example is illustrated by the certification, but let's give another one. A very common example. On a street situation, someone's shooting at another person intending to injure that person in a crowd. That's a particularly egregious act. Misses that person but strikes another innocent person, a bystander. Under the interpretation of Boomsma, there could be no assessment of punitive damages because the malicious conduct, the intentional disregard of rights, wasn't directed at the particular plaintiff who happened to have been injured. And another example from real life, let's take a road rage incident. We see people all the time on the highways who get involved in these, I guess, testosterone-induced sometimes activities, which are designed to, you get in some way, tailgates, they slam on the brakes, they speed up, cut the other person off, and there's this exchange, an escalating exchange of very reckless, in fact, outrageous conduct, which could result in one of those people being driven off the road into the path of an oncoming vehicle. It has nothing to do with the circumstances. Now, are we to say that the legislature intended, under Boozman, you'd have to say that that person who's injured by that conduct would not be able to ask a jury to determine whether punitive damages are properly to be assessed against that defendant or those defendants whose outrageous conduct, I use the term outrageous as a shorthand term, as this court has done in the past, for the type of conduct that will support an award of punitive damages.
If we were to adopt the concept that has been argued of intent as applied in a criminal setting, does that bring along with it the doctrine of transferred intent?
Yes. I think transferred intent in what sense, Justice Butler?
Well, your example of you shoot at one person, miss, and you hit the third part.
Sure. Sure. I think that, and the Civil Justice, Civil Judges Jury Instruction Committee recognized that, that transferred intent concept. But it's significant that in the instruction itself, they don't say intend to harm. They say intend to disregard rights. Because the question has to be, intend what? And in the statute it says, intentional disregard of rights, not intend to cause harm.
Well, put side by side your understanding of the defendant's interpretation and your interpretation. My understanding is that they say intend to disregard plaintiff's rights means intend to harm this plaintiff. Do you agree with that?
No.
Well, I mean, do you agree that that's what they want?
That is the argument that the defense makes in this case, and it's a logical extension of the interpretation in Wisher and Boonsma.
Okay. And your interpretation is precisely what?
That in order to determine assessment of punitive damages, the jury must find that the defendant acted in intentional disregard of the rights of the plaintiff. And as long as the plaintiff has the rights which the defendant acted in disregard of and is in the class of those people who are subject to that disregard, then I think a reasonable and logical and, frankly, common-sense interpretation is that punitive damages are potentially assessed.
Right. And what were the rights of the plaintiff here?
In this case, the rights of the plaintiff were no different than the rights that you and I have when we get in our car to go home at night, and that is to be safe, a right to expect that people will not violate the laws of this state and drive under the influence of alcohol in such a manner as to decrease their both their physiologic and cognitive abilities and impair them in the handling of their automobile. Now,
that above 0.08?
No, not necessarily. Only see, here's the situation: not every drunk driving case, quite frankly, would lend itself to a submission of a punitive damage case. This legislature has recently lowered the standard to 0.08. It doesn't take much to get there. That doesn't mean that there's an impairment of a degree that would lead to an assessment of punitive damages. One would have to determine when the alcohol was consumed, what effect it had on that particular individual. I think you also consider, as the judge correctly did in this case, the awareness of the individual who was operating under that influence of the potential effects of that. This is a no-brainer case. This is a case where the defendant was 0.269, had drunk, almost a case of beer, a 12-pack and a half, 18 cans of beer in a short period of time. Here's what this defendant did: made a conscious decision to drink, having been through alcohol assessment, having been convicted of drunk driving on many occasions, knowing the effects of that drunk driving, knowing the effects of alcohol on him, because that's part of the educational process, made a deliberate choice and conscious decision after drinking a 12-pack to get in a car and go to the bar and drink some more.
knowing consciously that he would have to get in the car again and drive home with a passenger, knowing, and then getting in the car after drinking six more beers at the tavern to head to another tavern to drink. That, to me, is a no-brainer in terms of whether this person acted in intentional disregard of the rights of the users of the highway.
All right, counsel. So looking at all of these arguments, and your opposing counsel talked about, well, this will take care of, when we talk about a person that's speeding, it would affect people at speed. Your example here is, well, if I've been apprehended four times speeding, but I make the conscious I'm going 100 miles an hour on I-39, and I've had three prior convictions, and then, of course, an accident has to happen. It's the unusual, or it's the, let's say, the exception to the rule that you're talking about here.
Yes, and each case would have to be considered as it is under the current, under the common law, on its own facts. The trial judge would have to assess the evidence. Evidence would have to be introduced to show the level of awareness of that particular defendant.
Just like not all drunk driving cases, not all speeding cases.
That's correct.
Counsel, my concern lies in the argument of the excessive nature of the amount or the excessive amount of this punitive damages award. And, of course, in Trinity, the court set forth the considerations in Wisconsin, borrowing upon the BMW and State Farm considerations. You've discussed the egregiousness of this, you know, the prior offenses, the made deliberate choice, trying a 12-pack. I can hardly comprehend that. But there are other elements. You know, so I agree, it's awful, it's bad. But what about, in looking at Trinity, whether the award bears a reasonable relationship to the award of compensatory damages? And this seemingly bothered Justice Crooks also when he asked the question. The potential damage that might have been caused, the ratio to civil or criminal penalties, the wealth of the wrongdoer. How do those other elements balance so that we should affirm what the jury did here? I mean, how do you, and especially focusing on the reasonable relationship and the ratio.
Well, I've already addressed to some extent the reasonable relationship of the ratio to the actual compensatory damages. And as you pointed out in reiterating what this Court said in Trinity, it's also the potential damages that resulted. Only one factor, not a bright line test. The other factor being, as you mentioned, the relationship between the award of punitives and the criminal penalty that might be imposed. In this case, a fine and a year in jail. Well, the argument that Hogner makes is that that's pretty small compared to $225,000. Well, with due respect, if the court, one of the significant punitive damages cases in this state is Miller versus Walmart, spending a year in jail is a significant penalty, and is not to be said that it's insignificant in compared to $225,000. It obviously wasn't effective or hasn't been effective for this defendant. But remember, in Miller versus Walmart, a jury awarded $20,000 for a very brief detention, an improper detention of a person who had been shoplifting. So if you look at what that penalty is, that's notice to a defendant that that's a significant, potential significant penalty from the conduct that's being punished. So there is no real disparity, in my view, between the criminal penalty and the civil penalty of punitive damages that the jury imposed here. The jury simply concluded, as it had a right to do, that the criminal penalty was not enough to deter this individual or to punish him or to send the correct message to the public about what to expect if you are a repeat drunk driver.
Justice Crooks also asked the question of what import is the argument for $25,000 at closing. And your response was, well, sometimes, you know, we offer conservative amounts. Well, and I'm shorthanding your response. Mm-hmm. My thought is that hopefully you offer what you think would be a reasonable amount. And if indeed I'm right, I might be wrong, but if I'm right, don't I have some ability as a reviewing court to look at what was argued and say, the attorney must have thought that that was reasonable, punitive damages for compensation given the other elements here. But so I guess my bottom line is, of what merit and value, I reiterate Justice Crooks's question, is the argument advanced by counsel in closing? How do we weigh that in?
I want to make sure I emphasize that if the jury had decided that $25,000 was an appropriate amount, that would have been considered in the range of reasonable for this conduct. But this Court, as it said in Trinity and other cases, defers to the fact-finding process of the jury in terms of what's appropriate under the particular facts. And I suggest that the suggestion of counsel as to a reasonable amount is not part or shouldn't be a critical component of whether the jury made an excessive award. Now, there's a de novo review also, and that's the due process review that this Court undertakes. And again, I've not seen in any of the due process analyses that, of the cases that I've read, where what counsel asked for in punitive damages is listed as one of the factors in determining whether there's been a violation of due process or whether the award is so excessive as to represent a violation of due process. The factors that have been clearly delineated here are the ones that we've been discussing. So I do not think that counsel's suggestion of an amount of reasonableness, and frankly, had the jury awarded that amount, no one would complain. But doesn't mean that the jury couldn't have awarded a lesser or a higher amount and still been reasonable, given what it heard about the facts of this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Laufenberg. Ms. Kingsley, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me first address the ratio issue and some of the constitutional concerns that have come up that I could not get to earlier. It is our position that 112-to-1 ratio is not constitutional. Mention was made that the court defers to the fact finder. That is not the case. The Leatherman decision, the State Farm decision, the Trinity decision all talk about the fact that it is de novo review on that issue. Then the argument was made.
Also, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just, I'm concerned about this ratio. You're saying as a matter of law, 112-to-1 is unconstitutional. Well, what if this is Microsoft? Did you feel the same way?
That's an interesting point.
Because
the court, the State Farm case talks about there can be upward deviations in two limited circumstances. One is if the injury is hard to define or to quantify. Certainly wasn't the case here. The jury heard tons of testimony, economists, rehab people, and found that it was very easy to quantify, and it was $2,000. The other instance the State Farm court talked about was if it's a particularly reprehensible act, there may be a deviation from that standard. But the court also goes on in that same paragraph and says, but in the end, you have to look at this particular defendant and the harm to this plaintiff. And that runs contrary to the argument that you can look at the harm to society as a whole. State Farm repeatedly says that when you are looking at the ratio and whether or not there can be a deviation, you look at the harm to the plaintiff. Now, it's been argued, well, there really was a property damage component, too, and that can be factored in. No property issue occurred at trial. There was no property damage claim which took place at trial. To say now that we can sit back and even though the jury couldn't consider property damage, we can now add that in and therefore somehow justify this deviation, I don't think that's appropriate. I think you have to look at the facts that were before the court at the time to determine whether or not this was reasonable.
So are you saying that no deterrence should be considered in setting punitives?
Well, certainly that's one of the things that the State Farm Court talked about. It talked about recidivism, that type of thing. But in the same paragraph, it said you look at that, but you also look at was the act due to trickery, malice, or was it a mere accident? And this was a mere accident.
Well, it may have been an accident in turning in front of a car. But the point of the matter is what you have is a recidivist driver who drinks. This is the fifth time he was caught. studies show that there are lots of times that someone like that will drive drunk and not be caught. Common sense tells us that. How do you deter recidivist drivers when assessment doesn't work, education doesn't work, suspending the driver's license doesn't work? How do you deter him, and how do you deter others like him, of which we have a large number? And in this society at the present time, drunk driving is viewed as a very evil act.
How do you deter it? You, first of all, the imposition of criminal penalties, which I understand your argument in this case. However, with the imposition of this penalty, which was by far the largest for Mr. Hogner, I think it's mentioned in the court records, there have not been additional drunk driving arrests. You talk about the point of punitive damages is to deter, and then it was mentioned, well, what's the ratio compared to what the sentence was? It's important to know in this case, he was sentenced. He did serve time, contrary to, I believe, what's in respondent's brief. It was
but he gets out. He has probably served some time in the other four, or at least in three of the four, and he gets out and he does it again. How can you deter him, and how can you force others to deter him, like his family? He'll never inherit a dime from him on the basis of this. Maybe that's where who you're deterring in this case.
Two things. One, the legislature can deter by stiffer penalties, by codifying it as it has done in other states, that if there is drinking and driving involved in an accident, then you put in your statutes that automatically complaints can be amended to allege punitive damages or issues can go to the jury. I think that's addressed to the legislature, as is some of the problems with the underlying statute here. As far as deterrence, I think it was well argued in the amicus brief on behalf of Mr. Hogner in this case. If you are talking about a person with a serious alcohol problem, I don't know that there's any guarantee that a stiffer punitive, the possibility of punitive damages in the future, or even the imposition of punitive damages, are going to have a deterrent effect on future conduct.
Chief, if I may, I understand your red light is
on.
Just one final question. Aside from the ratio, which you pointed to, what either happened in this case that shouldn't have or didn't happen that should have that renders this particular award unreasonable, irrational, and arbitrary?
Let me make sure I understand the question. What happened in the case which resulted in the award which we
believe? You're arguing that the award is unreasonable. I want to see, other than the ratio, how do you get there?
First of all, it's our position that the issue should never have gone to the jury in the first place, based upon the wording of the statute, which would have directed that an individual. And as I said earlier, even under Levro, the conduct, because it was not directly tied to drunk driving in this case, and because the conduct was not a drunk weaving down the road, was a left turn. And in Levro, they found that under the old standard, that should not have gone to the jury. So in the first place, the jury never should have considered this standard. I guess primarily the other argument then is the ratio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kingsley, and thank you, Mr. Laufenberg, for I think the first argument this Court has had on interpreting this statute, and we'll hear more about it later today. That closes the hearing on 03-2527, Strenke versus Hogner. The Court is in recess until 1:30, when it will hear the third case for today and last case for our October sitting. We are